Well, there are many wild plants and mushrooms that grow in our landscape that are edible, but figuring out the good ones from the bad ones can sometimes be tricky. We're going to take a look at that right now. Larry Mueller here. Our guest is one of the Midwest's best-known foraging instructors. He's a member of the National Wild Foods Association Hall of Fame, Mike Crable. He is the author of several field guides, and his latest book is called The Scout's Guide to Wild Edibles, Learn How to Forage, Prepare, and Eat 40 Wild Foods. You may have some questions about wild edibles. You may have some experiences to share. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Larry. I appreciate the opportunity. One of my good friends that's well-known in Wisconsin is Sam Thayer.
Oh.
And he provided many of the insights that I've been able to put into the book that I think people will find very helpful when they forage.
You know, I as looking through this book, I thought, this is a nice book. You've zeroed in here on 40 wild plants that really we can find and are prevalent in our state.
Right. I chose to reduce the number to something that was manageable. The first goal that I had in mind was to produce a field guide that was truly a field guide, one that you could slip into the back pocket of your pants if you were heading out, or into a day pack, or even carry around in the glove compartment of a car.
I like that aspect of it a lot. And you've got... Describe, you've got number of wonderful photos that really show the plants.
Thank you.
And talk about what someone's going to find when they open up the book.
One of the things that people will find as they thumb through the book, as you might at a bookstore, are quite a few photos. There's a field guide section up in front that has the 40 wild edibles, and the 40 wild edibles would include 33 common plants that taste good.
Yeah.
Ewell Gibbons hit it right on the head when he said in his book, Stalking the Wild Asparagus, back in the 1960s, he said, you know, there are a lot of plants out there that are supposed to be edible. I don't like all of them.
For sure. I love that quote, by the way.
Yeah. Well, besides the field guide section of it, there's also, and that includes plants and mushrooms, by the way, 33 plants and 7 mushrooms that are quite common, one or two of them found in the spring and the rest through the summer and into the fall. And after the field guide section, there's a series of activities, 10 activities that I've done as a school teacher with my 7th grade science classes, that the kids just love them. And they're the kind of things that now that the kids are grown up, Mr. Crable, do you have that recipe for dandelion donuts or whatever? And they can turn to this. Some of them are actually grandparents now, and there are activities that they could do with their kids or their grandkids. It's not just for scouts, even though the title is The Scout's Guide to Wild Edibles.
Yeah, I love that. And I also love the section on recipes.
Oh, yeah. There's 17. We were going to put 15 recipes in there that were tried and true, the kids absolutely loved, and that were favorites of mine. One, when I lived in Michigan for 30 years, that I found and shared with thousands of people is called Double Good Blueberry Pie. And Wisconsin has its share of blueberries, of course, too. But it consists of a matrix of raw blueberries, and then you have a cooked blueberry part that you add to it, and you pour into it, and you just, oh, it's wonderful. In fact, I had to make some of it for my brother when I was visiting him in North Carolina over the Christmas recess here. So, and everybody loved it.
Well, I tell you what, and you do call it, you mentioned you call it, it's the Scout's Guide to Wild Edibles, but really, you don't have to be a scout to and enjoy the book.
Oh, not at all. And that's one of the things that I mentioned in the introduction is that it's for everyone, from kids to adults, to youth group leaders, teachers, and parents. And whether a person is just a beginner or a seasoned veteran who really understands the kinds of wild foods and can identify mushrooms left and right, I don't think most of us are in that category. But it's meant as an aid to help. You know, positively identify what you've got. There's a reference in there, too, as a matter of fact, to a list on the internet on edibleweeds.com that if a person wants to find out who is near them that might know about wild foods and could take them out on a walking trip, there are contacts where a person can reach that. So resources are another part of the book in addition to the field guide and the recipes and the activities.
How long have you, how did you get interested in foraging, by the way?
Oh, probably at scout camp and also with my family. I think Dad was the kind of person that loved being outdoors. He was into hunting and fishing, and I don't know that he did any trapping, but certainly fishing became a lifelong activity for him as it did for us. And in the fall, we would get together with relatives in a nearby town, and we would have a contest to see, as we went out to gather hickory nuts, who could gather the biggest sack full of hickory nuts. And back at that time, of course, they were paper sacks. So you can imagine a big grocery bag filled with hickory nuts. You had to be careful not to let it rip, you know, and not to drop it. And I think my cousin won the contest one time. And unfortunately, he went after some hickory nuts that were around the base of a hickory tree that had poison ivy growing up it. And he wound up in a hospital and dressed up like a mummy, you know, wrapped all the way so he couldn't scratch his skin loose.
Oh, man. Well, we have lots of good stories in store for you here as we visit with Mike Krabel. He is the author of The Scout's Guide to Wild Edibles. We're going to take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us. Then give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at foraging for wild edibles today with our guest, one of the Midwest's best-known foraging instructors, a member of the National Wild Foods Association Hall of Fame, Mike Krabel. Mike is the author of several field guides, and his latest book is called The Scout's Guide to Wild Edibles, Learn How to Forage, Prepare, and Eat 40 Wild Foods. You may have a favorite forage food or maybe a question about foraging for foods, maybe a good recipe. We've got some recipes that we'll talk about today on the show because Mike's book has wonderful recipes, wonderful sounding recipes. I haven't tried any of them yet, but I certainly plan to. And in particular, dandelion donuts. Sounded really, really good to me. Mike, I'm going to ask you about them, but I want to take some calls first. If you have a question or comment, join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. David in Annawa, it is your turn. David, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Very fascinating topic. I'll try to be
the more I learn about this, the more I'm convinced that it's we have lost you. We've lost you, David. You might try calling back on another line. He had some questions, but he may try to call back. Let's go to Jason in Portage. Jason, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. How are we doing, Larry and Mike?
Great. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind today?
Well, it's a morel mushroom question.
Okay.
I'm an avid hunter, I guess you'd call them. And I go out every year to my little secret spot, and I've noticed that there it seems to be a cycle. And my question is, and I'll take it off the air, but is there a cycle, and what is it for, like, the blondes, the blacks, the grays, et cetera? And if you could help me, I'd greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Well, Mike, what do you think? Have we got a cycle with our morel mushrooms?
Thank you, Jason. I tend to have been a very poor hunter of morel mushrooms, and so one Christmas I decided to change things. And I spent the entire 2 weeks vacation that I had, I was teaching at the time, and did a lot of research, looked at movies, checked out books. Iowa had done a 10-year research study on the distribution and abundance of morels. And as I recall from that study that I did of a study, they mentioned nothing about cycles. So I'm wondering if it, but we all experience that when we go out to hunt morels, that's for sure. We find that there are years that are really good years, and there are years that are just lousy. And that's one of the reasons why whenever we stumble across the mother lobe, for instance, or a big patch of morels, that we are just besides ourselves with ecstasy. It's just wonderful to do that and to experience that. But I have not seen anything in print that describes a cyclic nature to morel hunting. I think there are a lot of environmental variables. Moisture is definitely one of them. Early temperatures are another. We found that in this study, for instance, that 53 degrees Fahrenheit was the temperature at which the ground needed to be at a 4-inch depth, 53 degrees, before morels would really appear. And you know and I know that we've had times when it's gotten warm really early in the year, and then all of a sudden it turns cold. There's a cold snap, and then the morel hunting just isn't worth going out. I think the best thing to do if you're a serious morel hunter is to do what a friend of mine does, and that is to travel around the country during morel season. There may be a state just south of us, for instance. Here in Iowa, we go down to Missouri, and we've often found them in Missouri when they weren't to be found in Iowa. And likewise, in Wisconsin, I know that we've had some people from Wisconsin come down to Iowa and be successful when we weren't, but it all depends on the progression of the season and the temperatures. That's a big, big thing, and moisture is the other large thing. I wish there was something I could say like, okay, it's every 7 years, and we just finished the sixth year in 2016, and so this should be a fantastic year. I did write something that you can probably search and find on the internet. It's called 50 Tips to Put More Morels in Your Basket. And that was based on the research that I've done, the people that I interviewed, and so forth. 50 Tips to Put More Morels in Your Basket. So hopefully that by itself will help you.
And in your book, certainly one of the mushrooms is the morel mushroom.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one that we all love. Or most of us anyway. Diane in Appleton, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, great. Hey, I'm lucky enough to have morels growing in my backyard. We live in the woods. And I listened to this last response about the gentleman who had questions about sort of good years and bad years. But my question is simply this. I hope my husband and I didn't make a mistake by using mulch or shredded bark in some areas around some of the trees that I have had morels grow and I've harvested. But I noticed the following year there's maybe nothing, and I never pull them out. I always cut them at the stem. could it be that I potentially have hurt them with that shredded hardwood mulch?
Unlikely, but it depends on what depth that you covered them. I think more than any particular kind of mulch. I do know that morels will actually come up where people have had apple peelings. And, you know, if you had apple bark or compost of some sort that they've been known to tolerate, then I don't think there would be any problem. But what kind of mulch did you put down?
It was just a simple shredded hardwood type mulch that you would get, you know, from any local, you know, landscape type place. So I couldn't be certain. I hope there were no, you know, pesticides right. or anything like that. But, yeah, I kind of regretted that. I was trying to keep the weeds back, but I hoped that I hadn't hurt the morels at the same time.
Well, yeah.
Well, the mycelium will work, you know, kind of like the roots of the morel. It will work through all kinds of litter above it, and it will constantly grow. One suggestion I would have is of setting out a sprinkler if it's not too far away, the water supply is not too far away for you, is to set out a sprinkler in case you, the soil is dry in that particular time of the year. The sprinkler, of course, bringing up well water as it might, the well water would be cold, and so it would chill down the mulch area. And as you, the temperature seems to be a critical component, too. So I would keep my hopes up. You could always do a little bit of raking back if you had to. But if you start seeing, as you rake, if you start seeing these white tangle of threads that are going through it from the fungus, then I would say, whoops.
Stop.
stop for sure.
There you go, Diane. Thanks a lot for calling. I want to give Sam in Rochester, Wisconsin, a chance to join us. Sam, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning, guys. Yeah, I just had a I had a quick comment about using wild edibles to spruce up a salad. I don't know if you mentioned it in the book. I'm not sure if you talked about invasives at all, or if you use them in your book. But most of
acorns
use that.
Invasives.
Oh, invasives. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, garlic, mustard, that sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, my family and I, we love a good salad, and we usually find ways to spruce it up with nuts and dried fruits and things like that, and a lot of different
Excellent.
Kinds of vegetables. But we don't use salad dressing. So what we'll do is we'll find something, a lot of times it's from the grocery store, but when garlic mustard first comes out, if you throw that on your salad, it has such a punch to it that you really don't need any dressing. And
well,
same with daylilies, they have such a good sweet flavor. And kind of almondy, the flowers themselves, you know, and even the roots. You don't want to take them off.
I'm glad you bring this up. My book, I've narrowed down the number of plants to only 33 that I feel are really easy to identify and abundant, and ones that you know I have good pictures of. As far as garlic mustard, I've eaten garlic mustard from the roots all the way up to the seeds and so forth, and it's not one that I would classify as a favorite. I think it's fine as one of the additions, but you certainly wouldn't want a salad solely of garlic mustard. And Sam Thayer, who's a good friend of mine, says that the stalks of garlic mustard before they flower, when maybe the buds are just there, but no later, they haven't opened up yet. He said if you peel the leaves off and just clip off the stalks, he said the stalks are juicy and delicious. And so when his book first came out where he described that, I could hardly wait to get out in the spring and gather some.
And give it a shot. Thank you, Sam. Thanks, Sam, for calling. John in Wisconsin Rapids, we'll turn to you next. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, appreciate the call.
Excellent. Hey, my question is, well, first of all, I'll tell you the story. Last year, my daughter and I were geocaching, and one area, we went into the woods. There's still snow on the ground, but very little, and there are so many wintergreen berries. I was just amazed. I haven't seen that many.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, I just was wondering, is this something that's on a cycle, or can I go back to the same place next year and find as many? Or
I don't know about its cycling. There have been times when I've seen gobs and gobs of them, as you have, and there are other times when there are very few and far between. So it there may be a whole host of factors, environmental factors there, but they are pleasant. They don't have much in the way of nutrition. They're kind of a pleasant taste, and the wintergreen flavor comes through very nicely. But, no, it's, I mean, you can continue to look. If you found a bunch in that habitat elsewhere, you know, might be worth checking out as well as going back to the original spot.
Okay, because this one spot, it covered a couple of acres almost. We just walked through the woods, and it was
wow.
Unbelievable, a lot of them there.
Wow.
Sounds impressive.
I'd go back.
Yeah, definitely. Worth looking in. Yeah, for sure.
Thanks, thanks, John, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. You know, an earlier caller mentioned, you know, these obnoxious weeds, and one of the weeds that certainly we hate is Japanese knotweed. And you've got a photo, some photos of Japanese knotweed and when to harvest and how to preserve the harvest and, you know, just how to really identify them. And I think you also have a recipe for Japanese knotweed.
Yeah. One of the my favorites was mentioned by Ewell Gibbons, and it was to make it like stewed rhubarb, and you could actually make a soup from it. It was like a fruit soup, and it had a it looked like pea soup, okay, but it tasted very sour, kind of like stewed rhubarb, and he put a little dollop of butter on it. To kind of smooth it out, and I love that. That recipe's not in my book. It's in his book on stalking the wild asparagus, but Japanese knotweed is one that I think people can find easy to recognize. Just don't do us all a favor and don't take a plant home and plant it in your yard.
Yeah.
It is so horribly invasive. You know, it just spreads like crazy.
You know, you mentioned the dandelion donuts earlier, and I thought, well, now here's one that most of us are going to be able to find dandelions. And those dandelion donuts, I'm going to try those.
Well, the secret to really good-tasting dandelion donuts is to get rid of the bitterness that dandelion has. Mm-hmm. And that's the secret. In my recipe, the very first time we tried to fix it, I had the kids go out and pick dandelions with a little bit of stem attached so that we could hold on to it, dip it in like a pancake batter from Bisquick or Jiffy Mix box or whatever, and just drop them in hot oil at 375 degrees. Well, they cooked up just fine. And then I told kids, nobody eats them until I show you how to eat them, because the green part that's right below the yellow is horribly bitter. It's what would cover the flower over, the little sepals that would cover the flower over. It's called the receptacle. And it contains sesquiterpenes that make it just really, really nasty. And so you have to pinch onto that with your fingers, then bite the rest of the donut away in order not to have a bad experience. And that's one of the things that I found out later on from a friend of mine, Dr. Peter Gale in Cleveland, Ohio, who is a retired botany professor and knows more about dandelions than probably anyone else in the world. He said, Mike, what you want to do is to squeeze the dandelion. If you squeeze it right on that green part and roll it back and forth under your thumb and increase the pressure, the yellow flower part comes loose, and you can pull it out and separate it from the green. He said, get rid of that green, use only the yellow in your batter, and make up your dandelion donuts that way. And we did, and kids absolutely love them. There's no bitter taste at all to them.
and something any of us could do, because I think it's pretty easy to recognize those dandelions out there. I'm going to give that a try this spring for sure. You know, there's another one that, you know, I don't know if you could call it a weed, but and I'm having trouble finding it. It had to be do with silver maple
seeds. Yeah,
the keys that are flooding our neighborhood every year.
Yeah, in the spring they just come down like an invasion of helicopters. It's really something to see, and then they stick up in the grass and will sprout into little trees that you have to get out there and mow your lawn so you don't have a forest taking place. But those seeds and the little wing part with them, it's called a samara, those you can gather, pick right off the tree if you want, and you can put them on a cookie sheet, sprinkle a little bit of peanut oil on them or whatever oil suits your fancy, and roast them in an oven for 20 minutes or so, and they become like potato chips. Little tiny pinch of salt. It's easy to overdo the salt, but kids absolutely love them.
I absolutely love that. I thought all of those little keys that I've got in my neighborhood, that would be one that I would really like to try. So I'm gonna give that a try, and I'm gonna give the puffball pieces as well. Because I run onto puffballs pretty often, and you talk about puffballs in the book too,
right?
Why don't you give us you don't have to go through every one, but give us our listeners a sort of an idea of the different ones that you've got in the book.
All right, I'm simply going alphabetically here. Amaranth, which is a very common garden weed and farm weed. It has kind of a red root. When you pull it up, the seeds of that and the young leaves of that are very good. Asparagus, everybody can recognize asparagus because the wild plant is the same as the garden plant.
Yeah.
It's just an escape garden plant. And so that's an easy one to find. And just drop it in boiling water for 3 minutes. It is crisp. Absolutely delicious, far better than any canned asparagus ever thought about being. Autumn olives, another invasive that I helped plant many years ago for wildlife travel lanes. Autumn olives, there's a secret to harvesting them. You've got to find out when they're just plump as can be and have no astringency, but they are absolutely delicious, make wonderful fruit leather along with chokecherry. Black raspberries, black walnuts, burdock, cattail. You can actually eat that brown sausage-like part of the cattail. It makes a wonderful vegetarian substitute for pulled pork. The texture is almost identical.
I saw that in your book, and I thought, oh my goodness!
Yeah, it's one of the delights of picking up a brand new edible wild plant book. I've got like 225 in my reference library downstairs, but it's finding something new to boldly go where you've never gone before. It makes a big difference. Mulberries. I've come up with a mulberry taffy recipe that I think people would enjoy. Lamb's quarter is a very common garden weed. Mayapple, often found in the woods. The whole plant is poisonous, but the berry, when it is ripe, it's about the size of a hen's egg. It can vary from a small hen's egg up to a large hen's egg. And that makes the most wonderful marmalade you can imagine. Milkweed, acorns, of course, and there's a simple way to process them that I found after many, many years. I didn't invent it, but I found it, and you just drop a handful of shelled acorns in a blender, fill it with water, process it, pour it into a colander in your sink that has, let's say, a dish towel in it, and run the water over them, stirring, and inside of 7 minutes to 15 minutes, depends on the...
You've got
good stuff.
This has been a lot of fun, Mike. Thank you so much, and thanks for your book. I'm going to enjoy it, and I'm sure many of our listeners will as well. Great to have you with us today. I really, really appreciate it. Mike Krabel is author of The Scout's Guide to Wild Edibles. And thank you for listening. Stay with us.
Lift your spirit and enrich your mind with Wisconsin Public Television's performance, art, and drama offerings. Satisfy your curiosity with Wednesday night science programs and learn more through weekend how-to broadcasts. Go to WPT.org for detailed broadcast information, and while there, sign up for an e-newsletter about upcoming broadcasts and events.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. Support also comes from The Century House, featuring Herman Miller furniture and stressless Norwegian recliners. On University Avenue in Madison, The Century House, furnishing homes and offices since 1948. More at Century.